Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
Warning. This episode contains foul language and touches on death, addiction, anti-Semitism, racism, sexism, heffalumps, and woozles.
Listening to Keep It Weird, the podcast for all things strange and unusual, bippity and boppity, bashful and dopey, and all around phantasmic. Each week we get a chance to sit down and chat about something weird, and this week is certainly no exception because we are venturing into the magical, mystical, and sometimes racially insensitive world of Walt Disney. There's no question that Disney is one of the most powerful companies in the world today, and it's not like they didn't earn it. Starting out in Los Feliz in 1923, the studio made flop after flop, and yet today, almost 100 years later, Disney brings in around $55 billion a year. Today we're going to talk about the man, the myth, the legend himself, and the beloved and not-so-beloved films that made Disney the shifty conglomerate monopoly that it is today. My name is Ashley, and this is my co-host, Lauren.
Hello, weirdos.
And today, we have a very special guest. You've heard him on the show before, and some of you have probably become fans of his podcast as well. From the hilarious show Movies That Made Us Gay, it's Scott Jungbauer.
Hello. Hi, weirdos.
Welcome back.
So good to be here.
It's so nice to be here in the air conditioning in the valley.
Yes. We're in person.
No, you're in Pasadena.
We're so in
important
person.
That we're in person.
Yeah,
I was
we
like,
are.
That's so special.
Also, we're in person.
I think that my first visit to Keep It Weird showed up on my Facebook timeline a couple weeks ago, and it was 2017.
That's
I think that was my first official sit-down podcast I ever did.
Really?
And that was when we
now
did
I'm
dolls.
Churning out one a week.
I was going to say, now you're in the big leagues.
Such a pro.
And I do remember it was for our dolls episode. Mm-hmm. We could not run the air conditioning because it was too loud for our single mic.
That's when we just
had
to
stop in the middle of it and
turn
it on.
We all were drenched and we had to stand up off the couch and like shake our bodies off.
Remember.
Like, shake the water.
It was really uncomfortable, really hot.
Really cute.
And it's good to know that we've come a long way.
We have. Look at this professional setup, guys.
And you guys are here with us. We're drinking sparkling seltzer, so you know what that means.
Burps.
It's time for me to belch. I also want to throw a disclaimer at the beginning of this episode because I don't want to come off as a heartless wench if I say anything bad about Disney. Because I like Disney. I love Disneyland. I like most Disney movies. But I also think it's kind of interesting because, you know, our show is Keep It Weird. We talk about weird things, but we also talk about the weird parts of normal things.
Yeah.
And when it comes to something like Disney, which is like magical and it's love and peace on earth and all this stuff, the things that make it weird are the darker things.
Right.
Are
sure.
the things
yeah.
that
like,
are like,
to talk
oh,
about that.
Like this happened and it was racist or this happened and it was blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I think that it's just interesting that we gravitate towards the darker side of Disney when we talk about the weird parts of it.
Right. Just kind of happens naturally. And it doesn't mean that we hate Disney. You're listening to three Disney fans
yeah.
in this room. Scott and I actually ran into each other
at
Disneyland.
We randomly ran into each other in Cars Land.
I was going to say it was by
like
the Cozy Cone Motel. Yep. We were getting
cone.
Some snacks.
And then
it was
we
very
ran
cute.
Into you again
yep.
at Galaxy's Edge.
Which was crazy. Yeah.
I can't remember
twice.
What the store is named.
Yeah. But
it's
I
where
know
you
what
buy
you mean.
Like all the fun Star Wars stuff.
Really I haven't been stuff. To Galaxy's Edge yet.
I haven't been back.
Yep.
It's very cool. I'm excited to see Avengers Campus. But...
We're going to Disney World next month. I'm trying not to psych myself out that we're going into like the heart of the beast of COVID.
Right.
Next month. But
it's Florida.
We'll be fine.
Also, we're vaccinated. And Disney World takes it super seriously.
Yes,
they do. Yeah. So if I had to be in any major crowd, I think I would want it to be at Disney World.
They're doing it the right way. They have good rules in place. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't think your travel will be hindered in any way because it's Florida. And we know that they haven't really cared about rules and regulations.
Florida Project. Yep. That was the name for Disney World.
Yeah.
When they were creating it.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah. The Florida Project.
Did you know it was supposed to be in St. Louis, Missouri?
No. What?
It was supposed to be Disneyland. Was supposed to be in St. Louis. Okay. But
I mean, it makes
Anheuser-Busch basically said you have to serve our beer at your park, and Walt was like, "I don't want alcohol in my park."
Which is something that they're finally caving to now.
Today, just now.
Like California Adventure LA has had alcohol for a long time, but now in Disneyland, you can get some alky. And does Disney World allow it too now?
I think just very specific places. And I think that Disneyland, it's only now going to be at the Blue Bayou, which... Right. Also, if you're going to be paying like $300 for dinner, I think I need a glass of damn wine.
Yes.
And then also the cantina. I think those are like the two places in Disneyland where you can get booze now.
The cantina in Galaxy's Edge is very fun. Ashley, I feel like you would really dig it. Just like aliens hanging out, serving you drinks.
For sure.
It's real fun. It's a good time. Oh, Disney. See, we like it.
We love it, guys. Just don't strap
take
it
too seriously. I mean, us at Keep It Weird can knock old Walt down a few notches.
Yeah, just down a few pegs.
It's okay
here.
To point out his problematic moments and still accept that he was a visionary.
And that's the thing. That's the cool thing about being a well-rounded person is that you can still enjoy someone and enjoy some of the things they make while also be able to criticize them.
Sure. Yep.
Like Walt, some people treat Walt Disney like they treat President Trump.
Yep. He's their god.
It's like, no, he's a god. He can do no wrong. It's like, well, technically.
Well, we have some issues.
He does a lot of things wrong.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about him. So Lauren's going to start today by giving us a rundown of Walt's least Walty moments.
Least Walty moments, yes. I'm not jumping into the movies, to be clear. I'm kind of focusing on his work life because he has a couple problematic moments that I thought we should call out.
Well, and I mostly wanted to do that to separate fact from fiction.
Yes.
Because so many people are like, Walt Disney was a Nazi or Walt Disney was anti-Semitic.
Yes.
And it's like, there's
very,
so many.
Very broad statements.
Yeah.
So broad. Yeah. And it's like, ooh, that's not exactly how it was, but how was it? What was he like?
Totally.
Was he an anti-Semite, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. That's what we're diving into. And we know that it's controversial. I was just saying before we started, my sweet husband Alex is at home crying because he thinks I'm just slandering Walt's name. And I'm like, listen, we're just stating historical facts. That's okay.
Everyone knows about the good things he did.
Yes. I'm like, we all still love him. It's great. He was a visionary, like created this brand new amazing world of animation, making the first feature length animation with Snow White. The theme parks, the overall magical experience. We love the Disney company, and he was a visionary for sure. He changed the game. That's all fine and good. However, there are just a few things in Walt's past that we're going to discuss. It was not all magic and rainbows. So some of the rumors, just to kind of list them off, are that he was anti-Semitic, sexist, possibly a Nazi, overly conservative, maybe a fascist, just all of the things. So let's dive in. Unfortunately, even though this would make for great gossip and a better story, Walt was not a Nazi. People want to believe it. I truly don't believe that he was. Because of his conservative views, he was found in some not so great groups from time to time. So I would say at most you could maybe call him a Nazi sympathizer, but even that almost feels too heavy. But basically what happened, I'll even quote one of his biggest animators, Art Babbitt, who they ended up hating each other by the end of Walt's life. He worked very closely with Disney for a long time, though. He was quoted as saying that there was a small but fiercely loyal and even legal following of the Nazi Party here in America. There were open meetings anybody could attend, and I wanted to see what was going on for myself. On more than one occasion, I observed Walt Disney and Gunther Lessing, his lawyer, there, along with a lot of prominent Nazi-affiliated Hollywood personalities. Disney was going to these meetings all of the time. And that was his quote in a book called Hitler's Doubles. And he was talking about Walt being at these meetings. And these meetings that Art Babbitt is referring to were meetings of the American Nazi Party that were just talking about how being Nazis are cool. And Walt was attending them.
What?
So that I'm just stating facts that he was seen there by multiple people.
I didn't know that.
Disney also personally hosted Nazi filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl, or Riefenstahl, sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong, when she came to promote her film Olympia in 1938, a month after the assault on Jews known as Kristallnacht, where Jews were killed and their property destroyed, like ripped out of their homes, things lit on fire. Horrific. Basically what, you know, put everything into action, like, for the Holocaust.
I knew about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he hosted her in 1938, right after that happened, gave her a tour of his studio, and Riefenstahl even commented afterwards that it was gratifying to learn how thoroughly Americans distanced themselves from the smear campaigns of the Jews. So she was with Disney all day, kind of seeing how they operate, and her takeaway from all of it was like, wow, they're really staying away from those evil Jews. Like, I really like what he's doing. What? Not that Walt necessarily said anything to her, but what she was seeing made her think like, oh, we're on the same team. I'm into this guy. So those were two very bad things that did not, they just
so why
didn't
was
paint
he,
him in a good light.
Why was he going to American Nazi parties or Nazi meetings?
So this is the thing. Like, he never even made an official comment of like, this is why I'm here, which is what he should have done. It's very difficult to defend. And the meeting with this prominent Nazi figure, the filmmaker Leni, could be explained through their shared craft and business interests. But either way, it was just in such poor taste that everyone was mad. Even his close colleagues were like, why'd you do that,
what
dude?
What the hell?
And as far as going to the meetings, he would just keep saying, well, it's because a lot of filmmakers, unfortunately, are part of this Nazi party.
Well, I know that the Nazi party kind of pioneered a lot of documentary filmmaking, too.
They did. And he was trying to learn a little bit more about it. So that is sort of, again, he never made the official statement, this is why I was there. But that is kind of what was concocted. And, you know, people close to him and what the company started saying was like, oh, he was trying to learn more. These were shared business interests.
Okay.
Yada, yada, yada.
My thing is, I didn't know about that. And before we went into this, I was like, I don't think he's an anti-Semite. And now I'm like, fuck Walt Disney. Wah, wah. That's fucking bullshit. Because this wasn't like, we didn't know what they were doing in Germany. Like, we had it all. We had all the information.
Yeah.
So I don't care. It'd be like me going to an ISIS meeting because there were good podcasters there. Be like, I just want to know what mics they use.
Okay, but also, like, what the fuck? I mean, in the defense of Walt, Art Babbitt only saw him there because he attended as well. So then you're kind of like,
that's true. So who all?
That's what I'm saying. I think people were. I do think people genuinely attended a meeting or two just to be like, what the hell are these people talking about? And Walt very much could have been doing that, or maybe a colleague invited him, and maybe that's why his lawyer was with him, because that was Art's quote, that he was there with Gunther, his lawyer.
And maybe if he knew,
kind of help him.
Yeah, maybe if he knew that part of his legacy would be that he was a Nazi sympathizer, he might have like said something more about it while he was alive.
Exactly. I don't know. There's a part of me that thinks he was just truly naive and was like, I'm just going to this meeting because I like these other filmmakers and I want to talk to them. And it's like, no.
Yeah, but also,
you can't do that. Right? I'm not saying that he wasn't an anti-Semite, but I'm trying to think of things where I'm like, maybe he truly didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say when you weren't there.
I know. So we're thinking that he maybe went to these meetings and hosted Leni, the filmmaker, on the lot to, you know, talk about his shared interests, as I said. Also, him and Leni were both in similar situations. They were tasked with making propaganda for their two governments, respectively. She was making propaganda for Germany, and America had then enlisted Walt to make propaganda as well. So they might have been swapping advice. They might have been, you know, sharing stories. And also, another rumor I found online was that a possible explanation for this meeting is that Disney really wanted to get his films back into Germany.
After... Yeah, I was going to say, was it a weird distribution thing?
Yes.
That he felt like he had to go there and talk to someone?
Like, can somebody help me? Because Hitler had, like, basically outlawed, like, all American movies, saying Hollywood is controlled by the Jews and they can't be in here. So Disney was like, well, maybe I can get an inside scoop, but... Yeah, he, again, everyone was criticizing him for being with Leni Riefenstahl. I was like, what are you doing, dude? So even if it was professional, that one was a little hard to excuse.
Yeah.
And to get into the propaganda films as well, which, Scott, I know you had texted us about these. And so I was like, oh, I need to dive into these short films. They're so interesting.
Oh, they're bananas.
They're banana crazy. Town. I would say, like, I'm not going to do, like, a super dive into them. I'll talk about them a little. Go look up all these shorts on YouTube because they're fascinating. They're basically all 10 minutes long. I think one might be 12 minutes. Super short, but one of the biggest ones he did was right when World War II started, he made Education for Death, The Making of a Nazi in 1943. Disney animators used this film to describe the birth of an Aryan German before cataloging the indoctrination process of the Hitler Youth in a 10-minute documentary short propaganda piece.
Wow.
And basically this made Walt look better because all these rumors are going around about being at the Nazi party meetings, and he's being very anti-German in this whole piece, and he's saying, like, hey, they think they're a master race and this is wrong. So he came out with that and people were sort of like, okay, we're with you again. But he was being commissioned for these by the military and by the American government. So then you can also, you know, play devil's advocate and be like, well, he was kind of forced. But
and I want to say that at the time that there was sort of a pop-up military base on the Disney lot.
Yes, there was. They were they occupied them for like 8 months, I think it was. It was kind of a long time.
Well, because when, okay, timeline. When did Disneyland open? That was 1960-something.
No, it was in the 50s.
Oh, it was 50s. 55? What, Pete? You know it?
55.
We have an audience member.
We have
55.
An audience. Yeah, okay, so 1955. So, but Disney Studio, the one in Los Feliz?
Yes, this would have been the early one, right? I mean, or no, would this have been Burbank by
that would have been, I mean, in Los Feliz is where they animated Snow White.
Right.
Right.
And some of the early movies. And then they moved on the lot, I want to say, in the 40s, I think. They moved on the lot.
Probably around this time.
In Burbank.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think they were on the lot at this point. And yeah, there was military occupation on the lot because they were very close by to a base. And so then in turn, the military started being like, hey, you're great at animating and making films. I think you could speak to the people, so we want to use you for our propaganda pieces.
We can put them right before like a movie.
Exactly.
With the newsreel.
We need your little...
Did
we
he
need
get
your little...
any of that military money? I guess we didn't have the military industrial complex yet, so maybe he didn't get like big bucks, but I didn't know if
no,
he got
No, but he definitely
money.
Got paid for it. I will talk about that in a second. One of the other movies he made, I just wanted to talk about a couple of them. There were several, but he made another one called Commando Duck, where Donald Duck by himself destroyed an entire Japanese airbase.
I've seen this one.
We watched that one the other day.
I was like, that one is a little more popular, I would say. But yeah, that was definitely to make Americans say, like, Japanese are bad.
Right.
Look what Donald did. So that
was
kind
Donald
of,
did.
That was the lesson of that. He also made a short called Donald Gets Drafted, where we got to see the experience of a U.S. soldier basically from the moment of them being drafted, showing them get a medical examination when they first got to their base, and then showing them like meeting their sergeant for the first time, getting their uniform. It just like went through a day of being a soldier, but with Donald Duck as the example, because it had to be adorable. But what's funny is like we can sit here and giggle and be like, oh, that's such a funny cartoon. But actually people loved this one the most because I guess a lot of military families didn't know what was going on with their loved ones. It's
probably
like, what was their communication? Yeah, yeah. And they like kids and spouses alike were like, this is great. I'm so happy I learned about this.
Especially, I mean, you say you give them a kiss goodbye, and then the next time you talk to them is like if you get a letter once they've been situated.
That comes
you know?
So late. And
you better hope that you don't get like one of the officers knocking on your
door. Exactly.
Oh,
yeah. So that was probably a time where that was very much so appreciated to see someone as, you know, I don't know how famous Donald Duck was yet.
I think he was pretty big. Mm-hmm. He was
like,
one of the originals.
All of the classic shorts that we grew up watching, those were all from the 40s.
Yeah. Those were originals. So I think Donald was pretty well loved.
He was a friendly face.
Yeah, he was the friendly face they needed. So that one was received so well. So the fact that Disney was enlisted to make these anti-German propaganda films is not surprising at all because, again, the military was, you know, at his side the whole way. They wanted to show America what they were really about, get everyone on the same page, and Disney was the man with the power to produce something perfect for them. He would get the information out in the best, most relatable way with good old Donald. And when people saw how well the shorts did, more people started flocking to Walt to make animations. And he even made two shorts for the Treasury Department of the United States of America. The first one was called The New Spirit in 1942, and then an immediate sequel, The Spirit of 43, in 1943, which both centered around income taxes and convincing people to pay their taxes again.
Fascinating.
Through an adorable cartoon. Yep.
Wow.
That's the way to do it.
We should get the Disney company to make new films. I almost have propaganda films, but it wouldn't be propaganda, but like new films that teach kids how to like fill out a W-4.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And like,
yep. Nobody taught
apply
us
apply for a loan.
That is
what
so
is a
true.
401k?
The things that no one teaches us in school. I would love to hear it
we
from Mickey
of had,
and Minnie.
We kind like Schoolhouse Rock, but I would love true. For Mickey and Minnie yeah. to be
we
like,
learned how bills got passed.
Yeah.
I would love how to be an adult. I would love to learn how to be an adult through Mickey and Minnie. Yeah. That's my dream. Maybe even Goofy. Also, as Scott pointed out to me and Ashley, there's even a short film on menstruation.
I was going to say, did you watch
no,
the,
I haven't watched
watch
it yet.
Oh, I watched it. Yeah. I couldn't not. It's so
is it
weird. It's cringy.
Accurate?
For the time, yes.
Okay, I was going to say. Yeah, or are they like, once a month, you're cursed by a witch and your underwear gets ruined?
Sort of. No, it was accurate, but still a little cringy and bizarre. It was a mm-hmm. weird watch yeah. for all sure. Right. It's called The Story of Menstruation. It was put out in 1946 and it was passed around to schools to educate young women, which like I'm all for. That's great. It was commissioned by the company, which today goes by Kimberly-Clark and has the brand Kotex under their umbrella, which if you're a lady, you've heard of them, feminine hygiene products. But it just makes me laugh. Like, who better to explain the menstrual cycle to us than a male-dominated animation company
yeah. Right? Yeah.
with no knowledge of the female body and somebody – and by men who don't respect any of the women who work for the company, which we'll get more into in a second. But they put out all these pieces. It was crazy. And you're sort of like, wow. I mean, that's great that he's doing this for all these people. Like, Disney's really coming around. But it was also beneficial for him. He
yeah,
wasn't just doing people
like
a favor.
It's not like he was doing it for free.
I mean, he's probably looking for funding.
That's
he's probably
what
looking
I was
going
to come to.
Because
yep.
especially,
he was looking for money.
Especially for that time of the 40s that the follow-up to Snow White, Pinocchio didn't make a lot of money.
It didn't, like, and neither did Fantasia.
I don't think it made it. I don't think any of those two movies made a profit for the studio. I mean, the studio features wouldn't really see an actual cash profit until Cinderella in like the 50s.
Right. Well, and Walt was also known for taking the movie that he, or the money that he had made from the previous movie and just pouring it into the next. So yeah. nobody ever got paid or saw that money really. Like, he was just giving everyone like the bare minimum, not treating anybody very well because he was just saying, okay, everything, all this cash, everything we yeah. just yeah. got into the next
it has
movie.
To go back into the studio.
Put millions into Fantasia, which today we all love and has become to be more appreciated, but it was a total flop.
We just revisited Fantasia, and it is...
It's tougher now.
It is fascinating to watch.
I've never now. Watched it high, and that's my new Ooh. Plan, is that
Why
I...
Why okay. haven't we? I haven't
sure.
either.
I want to get stoned
and watch
it. I
mean, you have to wait until the very end of the movie for Night on Bald Mountain, too.
Which is...
Yep.
Hopefully, I'll be sober by then.
Which is amazing.
Because wait, I don't want to
Can I
get
come
scared.
Over for this? Because
yeah.
I've also
yeah.
never watched it high, which
Absolutely.
Is surprising.
I really want to do that.
Just clip those little black children from the horse number.
Oh, God.
I was going yeah. to say that yeah. there's a slave centaur
still...
part. Yeah.
Those were like edited decades
I do think
ago.
They're probably out yeah, okay. now, but yeah, as a kid.
I think those were
but,
out
but
for the...
Sad
I think those were. I think those were... edited during like the 90s home video release.
I think so too, because they did re-release it and we're like, we made it
well,
prettier,
that's
but also
kind of
edited.
The problem with, and I get into it in like my section more, but like when you're like, I didn't even think about it when I was a kid, it's like, yeah, you don't. And that's what the issue
that's
is that the kids are given these images of, you know, whatever it may be, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, Pocahontas and John Smith had a loving relationship yeah, and it's like, oh God, no, that's not what happened. Mm-hmm. But you go to show your kids these things, like Dumbo, for example, ugh. Because it's wonderful. And you'll cry every time Dumbo's mom sings to him. And it is so wonderful. And then you forget that there's like really racist depictions.
And you forget about birds.
Yeah, and you forget about the crows.
Birds, yep. The crows.
And it's like, it's just something that when you were a child, it didn't faze you because you're a child and you're just like funny voices and cartoon. You don't think
right.
about it.
Right.
And then it. You know, it affects you whether or not you knew that it affected you.
Totally. That is exactly the problem. You're so right saying that.
Which, I just have one statistic I have to tell you. It's not yes. in my notes. A little political, but so gird your loins, guys. But I'm not saying this to be political. I just thought it was fascinating. In 2015, 30% of Republican voters in the United States said that they would vote in support of bombing Agrabah.
Oh, sure.
No. No, which... that can't be real. That can't.
I mean, it's a real place, right?
No.
I can't. It is. I don't believe
fantasy.
That.
Fantasy?
No.
I remember that.
Yeah. I'm upset by that.
So, it matters.
It absolutely matters. Oh, anyways. My. I did not know that. I'm so upset.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Walt was hired to make these, we could probably thank these propaganda movies for Disney Studios even existing. Because like you said, like he was not making money at the time.
That was literally one of my next notes. Yeah, like he was in a huge financial struggle. That's why this was beneficial for him. Like a lot of people defend him for, you know, the anti-Semitism and all the different things going on. Because they're like, but look at all these pro-America movies that he put out. He's so for the people, but he
got paid.
Basically had to make these movies. Like, truly, when you say Disney was saved because of it, 100% Disney exists today because of these short films. He poured all of his money, again, from one film into the next, and he poured extra money into Fantasia. I should have written it down, but I think it was well over $1 million he poured in. It made like $300,000 back. It was a total flop. I know we all loved it as kids, and it went on to be successful, but it flopped.
An experimental.
It was so experimental.
Art movie.
It is,
yeah,
for like children, which
it's incredibly
I mean,
artistic.
Like studios now would never make that.
Yeah, and there's only one scene with Mickey, so if you're looking for him in his wizarding hat, it's like he's only one part of it, and the rest, is this art piece to classical music, which I think people have come to appreciate now, but it totally flopped at the time, so they were losing money.
And it's so interesting that movies like Pinocchio and Bambi didn't land with audiences.
I know. Yeah.
Because those two movies are incredible to look at.
They're so beautiful.
And is it just one of those things that just audiences just didn't know better? Mm-hmm. They were still maybe a little like cautious of a 70 to 80 minute cartoon. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
They were like, wait, feature length films are still brand new to us. We don't know how to react. That could totally be true. Yeah, so realistically, the money from these short films is what kept Disney afloat. He was about to file bankruptcy. He didn't know what to do. Roy, his brother, was desperately trying to get more funders and investors and was not having any luck because they were sort of like, yeah, you guys have been into some sketchy stuff lately. I don't want to work with you. So they weren't getting investors, so he basically had to do these shorts. He had to fire a bunch of people, which is a whole other thing. That's why he needed the money so badly. He could not manage his money well at all. He was losing money from his flops, and he thought that just laying off like 70% of his animators would do the trick and it would be totally fine. But of course, his employees were smart enough that they all band together and did a labor strike, like this huge 4-week-long labor strike saying, we deserve better than this. You can't just drop us at, you know, the drop of a hat. We need this company to join the union. We need our rights and we need, you know, our fair
wages.
Also,
by the way, you haven't paid us for the last two movies.
Yeah, and they didn't pay anybody.
12-hour days and just underpaid.
His top animators were getting chump change, like nothing at all. And, you know, treating the women horribly, which we'll talk about a little bit. I mean, not horribly, but not well. He thought he was saving his money after laying off this huge portion of animators, but this just angered everybody. So the labor strike went on and on. It's not a crazy request at all, but Disney was a man that believed he was above taxes, above labor unions. He
sounds like a Nazi.
It does. That's why he's hard to defend sometimes, which, again, I know Alex is going to be listening to this and crying, and he'll have a lot to say next week. But Disney thought he was above everything, and he thought Disney as a company could be above everything. And that was his whole belief. I don't want collective labor. I don't want all the employees to, you know, band together and have this. I want us to be our own thing. And he would always like kind of call it his utopia. And that still that went into the parks, too, you know, of him saying, you know, this is our happiest place on earth, our utopia. I want to be above the law, which, again, will be a conversation for next week. But this started very early on. And he was so anti-communist and so anti-unions.
I was going to say he soon like, oh, I can use the communists as a reason to tell the press of why I don't like labor unions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He was using that. He was basically calling all of his employees communists, saying that they were fighting for this.
One of those things that we're, I think, so used to living in Los Angeles, Hollywood being a very open, liberal environment on the outside.
Totally.
But I mean, the 40s, it was not like that.
No.
That, like, Hollywood used to be a very conservative business. Did you guys ever see Mank?
Mm-hmm.
And Mank is all about sort of the election of the governor with Upton St. Clair and making all these propaganda films to try to not get him elected.
And also just, but if you actually like work in Hollywood these days, you know how conservative. It still yes. is. It still you is. Know how many...
It might
many,
be liberal on the outside, yeah. but yeah.
You know
the
how
people
many...
People call them the shots.
Especially gay men who are actors who yeah. are told, like, keep your husband a secret yep, because you're a heartthrob and blah, blah, blah. That's changing a little bit. Thanks, Ryan Murphy. But
true.
Ryan Murphy's done a lot for that. But yeah, it still has a ways to go. So it's not the
it does.
Left-leaning utopia.
That everyone thinks
but yeah,
is.
This sort of seems like when bosses, like Joe and I said this on a recent episode of our show, where like if you have a boss that says we're like family here, run. Mm-hmm. Just
right?
run.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because that mm-hmm. means we are going to take advantage of you at every 100%. Turn of the bend.
Yep.
And you're going to take it because we're like family here.
Totally sure.
I mean, that was his whole, that was Disney's whole belief. Yeah. Like, we're a family. You're going to be my loyal workers. And in return, like, you're going to be part of the best company there ever was. And we're going to be the happiest place on earth. But we're not going to do anything by the book.
I yeah. mean, kind of side note with my job working at a grocery store at mm-hmm. the beginning of the pandemic, I got my first taste of like union sort of reaching out to Trader Joe's employees. And our company was very strict of the, you should not talk to these unions.
Really?
And I just remember thinking, like, I really don't want to hear this from you.
Yeah.
Like,
this
I,
isn't
that is
the
really
reaction I would
business.
Like. Right.
I mean, like, I would have never, like, it's not really a career that I picture myself being at for very long. So I would never even, like, look into all the union options just because,
right.
like, I don't even want to go there.
Sure. Uh-huh.
But yeah, I just remember in a work meeting when they were talking to us about not talking to unions, ugh. I wanted to be like, you know.
You know
it's
what?
It's really none of my business. Or like, that is really none
me
of your
the
business.
Wrong yeah. way, guys.
Right. Yeah. This isn't making me want to yeah. stay. Yep, that was Disney perfectly. And mm-hmm. there was a famous moment documented where employees said that Art Babbitt, who was kind of leading the charge, mentioning him again, which is why they didn't like each other, one of the head animators, he got on a megaphone and, you know, was trying to ramp up
just,
the strike.
I was just watching a Disney documentary today. And they talked about, yeah, Walt got out of the car and they got into like a brawl.
A
and they had to like
grab the megaphone
them.
Out of yeah. his hand and tried to punch him in the face. I don't know
he
if he actually landed a punch.
He was getting like chauffeured into work.
Yep.
You know I love
with
drama.
All the crowds,
I know.
And he got out and they like got into like
they
pretty
a
much
scuffle.
A fist fight.
I don't
yeah.
know if any of the punches landed because people were trying to jump in, but they got in definitely a scuffle and he tried to rip the megaphone out of his hand. And again, it's because Art Babbitt was speaking truth and saying what the employees deserved, and Walt is just sitting there saying, "You're all communists."
Art
if you want
pretty
to
scrappy, unionize. I think that he could have handled Walt.
I think he could have too. Luckily, it got broken up because Walt could have really been taken down. But Walt was very conservative. He didn't shy away from his anti-communist beliefs. He was heavily associated with the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, and was very vocally anti-communist and anti-collective labor. However, it was believed at the time, and this was even confirmed by Meryl Streep just a few years ago, that the Motion Picture Alliance was not just anti-communism, but also a bit anti-Semitic.
Oh, wow.
Back
what
in the day,
surprise.
Unfortunately, maybe things have changed, but it's because anti-communists conflated communists and Jews at that time. That just
sure.
is sort of what happened. So it happened naturally.
I
of
mean,
like,
you see it even happening. It's still
I
happening
it's,
today.
It's not gone,
it's a, it's
but
still
it was
here.
Heavy then.
Yeah.
Yes, that communists and Jews were kind of the same in their eyes. It just really stuck with them. So Meryl Streep said these bold words in a speech before the National Board of Review in 2014. I mean, it was a long speech that I'm not going to quote, but she basically was saying, you know, Walt did amazing things, and, you know, I'll give him his credit, but he was also a misogynist, anti-Semitic, all of these things, which was crazy, and everyone was like, Meryl! But it was actually corroborated by Disney's grandniece, Abigail Disney, so it doesn't look
and
great
Abigail
for
Abigail Disney kind of has a reputation of being a big loudmouth.
She is.
Too.
She
yeah.
tweets things.
Yeah.
She doesn't shy away.
And she fully calls out the Disney Corporation on their bullshit.
Yeah.
On Twitter.
She does. Yep. She's like, she's
I have a new Twitter follow.
I know. Mm-hmm. She's known for doing that. So it's like sort of these things are becoming confirmed where it's like, oh, no, it's just the Motion Picture Alliance. Like, they just put out movies. It's fine. But it is coming out more and more that they were very anti-Semitic back in the day. And I mean, very anti-communist. That part was at least like at the head of it. But just to go back to that labor strike again, obviously, eventually after 4 weeks, it was confirmed they were able to become a union. They were treated the right way to much of Walt's dismay,
and
but
I believe that Walt was traveling through South America when they settled all of it. Did you read that?
Oh, I didn't hear that.
I
yeah,
know that he wasn't.
He was traveling
he wasn't
through South
probably
America
just trying to hide
because he
away.
Was sort of developing just sort of outreach to the Latin American countries, and that's kind of creating content of just like
Right.
Yeah. Because he's probably just wanted money too.
Well,
I'm sure.
But yeah, and then he ended up making like the three Caballeros.
Yeah.
Yep.
For sure.
Right after Song of the South.
Mm-hmm. Ugh, which, yeah, obviously has its problems. But I mean, see, that's the thing. It's like we have these negative Walt stories where you're like, why did you do this, Walt? But then also I kind of appreciate him traveling to these places and actually trying to genuinely learn about the culture before making a movie. I don't know. That's why sometimes you flip and flop on this dude. But yeah, so I then fast forward again. Sorry, I was kind of going back and forth because I didn't finish my thought on the labor union. Like, they became a union. They did win, even though Walt was pissed. But Abigail Disney, when she commented on Meryl Streep, I just wanted to read her quote because I thought it summed up so well how we all feel about him. She says, "If you are going to have mixed feelings about a family member, and we all do, take it from me, you really need to be as honest as possible about those feelings, or else you are going to lead yourself into many a blind alley in life. Anti-Semite? Check. Misogynist? Of course. Racist? Come on, he made a film, Jungle Book, about how you should stay with your own kind at the height of the fight over segregation, as if the King of the Jungle number wasn't proof enough. How much more information do you need? But damn, was hella good at making films, and his work made billions of people happy. There's no denying it. So there you go. Mixed feelings up the wazoo." Mm-hmm. End quote. And I think that is the perfect way to describe how we feel about Walt.
I think so, too.
I was going to say, Walt is just a product of his time, too.
Yeah.
Like, he was just a conservative white guy that was trying to make it in Hollywood. So, of course, he was going to embody all of those characteristics.
Yeah. You can unknowingly be a piece of shit.
Yes, I agree.
You can totally, innocently, unknowingly be a rotten piece of shit. And maybe that's just what he was. But like you said, he's brought so much happiness to so many people. His existence is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone can say we're glad he existed.
Yeah.
However, ..
You can call him out on his shit.
You can call him out on his bad shit.
It's kind of like how we all relate to someone like J.K. Rowling now.
Yeah, yep. Where it's like, oh my gosh, gave Harry us Potter Harry's
the perfect Potter. Example. Like, where you really have to learn to separate your love for the books or the movies from
or the product,
the creator and her weird beliefs.
Beliefs that came out of nowhere.
Because there's so many people who, my sister included, who have like Harry Potter tattoos who are like, I don't know how to feel about this now. It's like, you don't have to feel anyway about it. You can still love Harry Potter, even though now you can watch Harry Potter and go, oh, the way they depicted these things is, the name of the character? Is not great.
That's
or,
a little rough.
You know what I mean? That's a little rough. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So you can be of two minds with anything.
And Disney is a perfect example of that.
Alex.
I know. I'm like, Alex, listen, we love him. I do have one more point. Is there time? Or do you think I've been going on too long?
Ahead.
I know this has been a long time. The last point I wanted to drive was the sexism, which the reason I saved it for last is because in my mind, even as a female, I shouldn't be saying this, but it's the most forgivable because he was a man of his time.
Yeah.
And in this time, women were kind of treated this way everywhere. I mean, just put it on Disney.
You were regulated when you were a woman working for Disney of just painting cells because that was just woman's work.
Yeah. You can look back and be like, that was horrible. And it's like, okay, go to any other studio at
wasn't
the time.
Just Walt.
It's just it's shitty.
I wanted to include it just to, you know, cover all the bases.
But
and because, you know, we're women.
What he did to Snow White.
Oh, yeah. What? He blacklisted her pretty much.
He basically made sure that she never worked again.
Yeah, I can't remember her name.
How did I not hear this? Alex is, again, probably shaking his head.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't get to promote any of the movie. He wanted to keep sort of the voice of Snow White a secret. And kind of because of that, she just didn't really work a lot after
Well, she
movie.
Would try, and he basically said that he didn't want the voice of Snow White to be anything but Snow White. So she basically never worked again.
That's so sad. Okay, well, that really sucks. I was like, this is the most forgivable. I'm mad now.
Adriana.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay, I do remember that name.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, well. Capilotti? No, Walt, I take it back. You suck.
She was an Italian?
Was she Italian? Yeah.
Get
my girl.
And I believe that her house in Largemont Village in Los Angeles, there is a little wishing well in front of it.
Mm. I thought you were going to say it's the witch house.
No, that's
Wouldn't
in Beverly
that be
Hills.
Fun,
I was about
though?
To fall off of this couch.
The witch house is in Beverly Hills. Ashley Cassidy's dream house.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But having a wishing well is still cute.
Yeah, it was. There's a little wishing well. Do you know that the? Did you know the witch house in L.A. that was on a movie lot and they moved it?
No.
Yeah, that was on like a...
I just assumed some eccentric person.
I think that was on like the MGM lot or something.
Oh, really? And yeah. They just moved to the neighborhood.
And they just moved it to Beverly
anyone
Hills.
Anyone who lives in the LA area, you already know about the Witch House, but for anyone who doesn't, like just Google like Witch House,
just watch
Beverly
Clueless
Hills.
Because Cher walks by it.
She does when, walk by it. I just discovered that recently.
I think that it's the... When the Jewel song... All By Myself is playing.
This is why we have a movie expert on the show.
Isn't it? This is why we needed you on this podcast. I did read that recently that she walked by it, yes.
Listeners, if you want any movie knowledge in your ears, check out Movies That Made Us Gay. You will get those kinds of tidbits and more. Every time I come on or even like just like listen to Movies That Made Us Gay, I feel like I learn, I don't know, a hundred things per episode. Yeah.
I came on for What Lies Beneath, thought I knew everything about that movie. And you guys were just coming out with the fun facts of those actors. And I was like, who and when and why? It was so good. Anyway, we love you, Scott. And Pete, who's in the background.
And Pete, we love you.
Okay, so yeah, this is my last point. Walt only allowed women to be inkers at the company, which basically meant they got to just trace and fill in the work of their male colleagues. They were not allowed to be in the creative process at all or be part of the animation, the main job. They were even kept in a completely separate area, just like complete segregation. Like, women, here's your little box. You just do your inking. And on top of it, this was probably one of the most grueling jobs involved because they are going and filling in like every little bit, tracing over all of the lines with zero recognition. Nobody's getting talked
about.
Oh, yeah.
There is
about.
No women in like the credits of Snow White.
No. Nobody cares about the inkers. Nope. No.
I think that's always the thing whenever I revisit the older movies that really hits me hard of like, oh, there are no women on the crew of this movie.
No. It's very sad. Mm-hmm. But again, that's kind Boys of like
Club,
everywhere.
But just, I mean, Hollywood at the time, I mean, up until like... The 1980s, Hollywood was just a boys' club.
For sure.
I mean, shit, I'm surprised they even had women in films. I mean, I'm surprised it wasn't like a Greek play where the men played the women too. You know what I mean?
I mean, and I guess just the irony of that is that pre-code in the silent era, there was women filmmakers everywhere.
Yeah.
And then once sort of Hollywood became a business, it just became like the boys' club.
Yeah. Once it became profitable to be a filmmaker.
Yeah. On occasion, women would write into Disney and apply for a creative position with the company saying they had, you know, what it takes. And they were ballsy. They went for it. And I was actually able to find copies of the letter that the women would receive after they applied. There's a couple of different versions that basically the wording is identical except for, you know, the name changed to whoever it was for. And I have a photo of it that maybe we can post on our social media or our Patreon because the letterhead on this rejection letter just makes me giggle because it's just so Disney in every way. But I wanted to read the letter as my last thing just to show where Disney was at the time. Thank goodness they have progressed. Where is it? Okay. Hello? Oh, here I am. I'm so sorry. Your letter of recent date has been received in the inking and printing department for the inking and painting department for reply. Sorry, it's hard to read because it's like an old letter. So again, they wrote to the creative section but got a letter saying we sent it to inking and painting. Women do not do any of the creative work in connection with preparing the cartoons for the screen, as that work is performed entirely by young men. For this reason, girls, not women, girls are not considered for the training school. The only work open to women, they corrected there, consists of tracing the characters on clear celluloid sheets with India ink and filling in the tracings on the reverse side with paint according to directions. And then they go on to say, reply and write here to be an inker and painter. So that letter was just basically given over and over on adorable Disney letterhead saying like, hey, I know you wanted to be on the creative team, but instead,
no girls allowed.
No girls allowed. And then finally, when Walt decided that it was time to bring women to higher levels, which was only because of the start of the war, because men were starting to get drafted. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of young men animators and they were leaving. And he's like, shoot, all I have is a bunch of anchor women.
All I have is all these broads.
All these broads and the
what
pearls.
What am I
going to
do?
What will I do? So only because of that, he was able to, you know, kind of move them up, which whatever his reasoning was, even if it was backwards and we're all mad about it, that was the start of women moving up. And thank God now women are in charge of so much at Disney and there's, you know, directors and writers.
Were they
doing
able
all
to
the
stay
things,
on after the war?
They were.
Okay.
We got to give a shout out to Mary Blair. Are you going to talk about Mary Blair?
No, I just because I'm saying a million things. So go ahead.
We got to give a shout out to Mary Blair. Like, I mean, she was just like an American artist, an animator and designer. And she did concept art for Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, Song of the South, and Cinderella.
Oh, wow.
And just like her visual style is all over those classical movies.
True.
That's just like, it's just like you will know Mary Blair when you see it.
Yeah.
When you ride, it's Small World.
Yeah.
That's all just like her. Mary Blair.
Oh, wow.
And just, I mean, pretty much all of Alice in Wonderland is just Mary Blair concept art. So, like, one of kind of the big trailblazing women in animation.
And she's recognized for it, which is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he moved women up, and, like, thank God things changed, and this was the moment it became a little bit more progressive. But Walt still, obviously that letter kind of went back and forth between girls and women in the rejection letter, but Walt, when he was giving a speech to his employees saying, like, hey, things are going to change, women are going to start working more, only referred to them as girls. There's a little snippet written down of his speech saying, the girls are being trained for in-betweens for very good reasons. In-betweens saying, you know, like, moving up into, they're not just going to do the tracing, they'll be involved more. The first is to make them more versatile so that the peak loads of in-betweening and inking can be handled. Believe me when I say that the more versatile our organization is, the more beneficial it is to the employees, for it assures steady employment for the employee as well as steady production turnover for us, the studio. The second reason is that the possibility of war, let alone the peacetime conscription, may take more of our young men now employed, and especially many of the young applicants. I believe that if there's to be a business for these young men, it must be maintained for the war, and the girls can help us here. So three times he just said, the girls are going to help us, but then would say, the young men. And I was like, come on.
Yeah, but again, like, it's hard to hold that against him simply because you look at anything from that time.
Of course.
Watch League of Their Own.
It's all of them.
Can girls play ball?
Again, that's not even like an attack on Walt. I think I'm still just baffled reading the things that happened in the 40s of like, man,
especially
nobody likes the ladies.
That wasn't even 100 years ago. That's
right. It just seems too recent for us to just be the girls.
Yeah, the
but
gals.
Anyway, things have luckily changed.
Hi, I'm Courtney Fenner, and along with my co-host Amanda Cronin,
hey, hey,
we are Nefarious Nightmare.
We are a podcast that covers true crime, the paranormal, weird unsolved mysteries, and all with a personal approach and a sense of humor.
We also end our podcast with good life advice, such as wear deodorant or don't be a Richard.
Courtney and I have covered cases such as the Baker Hotel in Mineral Wells, Texas, and the tragic death of little Sharon Matthews.
We've also covered the case of Gloria Ramirez, who was, very unfortunately, dubbed the toxic lady in the media. And also, in episode one, we have an interview with Jason Vukovic, the Alaskan Avenger, and his sister, Angelina.
So let's all gather around the bonfire and roast serial killers and marshmallows.
Yes, yes, come on in, come on in.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Audible, pretty much anywhere you find really great podcasts.
Thank you guys so much for listening, and welcome to A Nefarious Nightmare.
Scott, do you want to tell us where we might find Walt Disney's head?
Oh, you're looking for a head? Uh-huh. Oh my gosh.
Does
Are you looking for
know?
The head of Walt Disney?
Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm sure that you've heard this urban legend.
Yeah,
everyone's heard.
Yes.
The
refuse to think it's an urban legend.
Like,
I think it's
Walt
real.
Disney is cryogenically frozen.
Yeah.
His head is like sitting beneath
Pirates of the Caribbean.
Pirates of the Caribbean. That's one of
the
big
the
parts
most.
Of the urban legend.
Wait. Before you get into it, I have to say the dumbest thing I've ever thought. When Frozen was first announced as a movie and I knew nothing about it, I thought it was going to be about his frozen head.
Well, there's a part of the urban legend is that Disney made Frozen. So when you Google Disney and Frozen.
That
the frozen head is not the first thing that comes up.
Of course they did.
Of course
those
they
sneaky
did.
Bastards.
So, I mean, I remember like an episode of Daria where they're playing like a car game and they're like naming off all of the letters of the alphabet.
Sure.
And Daria has C and she's like the cryogenically frozen head of Walt Disney.
Oh, yeah.
The best response
so
just, you could have.
Yeah, so it's just like ingrained
it's like a
in
part
pop culture.
Of our, yeah, pop culture mm-hmm. now.
The world.
So this rumor has pretty much circulated ever since Walt's death in 1966. There are variations on this popular myth. You may have heard that it was just his head that was frozen. I mean, that's very also Futurama.
I was going to say,
oh
did we
God.
Get that
yes.
from Futurama?
Yeah. That's okay. Are they that, the ones that started you would see it? In Futurama.
But Futurama had like Disney's Frozen Head and like Richard Nixon's Frozen mm-hmm. Head. Like there was a bunch
there was
of pets.
A few people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So sadly, there is zero concrete evidence that Disney ever wanted to freeze himself.
Okay. Well, that doesn't mean that he didn't.
I still believe it.
Were these rumors started that he was frozen by a few of the animators that worked for him? Maybe. There are, however, hard documents to prove that he was cremated and interned at Glendale Forest Lawn Cemetery. Oh, you can go visit his mausoleum. You can
go. Those are good hard facts.
But it's kind of one of those things that, I mean, it's maybe not too far off because it is very plausible when you really break it down. Walt was a massively wealthy individual with a passion for futuristic technology, and around the time of Walt's death, cold storage was becoming big, and the book The Prospect of Immortality by Robert W.C. Entger had come out, which inspired former TV repairman Bob Nelson to found the Cryogenic Society of California. And it was Nelson who told the LA Times in 1972 that Walt really wanted to be frozen, but the pair couldn't quite sort out the paperwork before he died in 1966.
So do you think this guy's...
sort of what really ties Disney to being frozen is this man.
This is just like a form. He's just a guy.
And he's just a guy that just founded the Cryogenic Society of California after reading that book.
Okay.
So he sort of kind of developed everything that we think of being cryogenically frozen.
Yeah, which is not like a hard science.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's
haven't
kind of,
quite figured that one
of,
out yet.
Haven't mastered
it's generally
it.
Viewed by the science community as quackery.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, because the thing is like, there are species that can be frozen.
Right.
Their heart can stop and they can thaw out and live fine. But they're not very complex species. It's like frogs, slugs, snails.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's ever happened with a person.
No.
I don't think that there's any like.
So I real kind of did science. A little deep dive and just
I know you were cryogenics you were watching
today, but I love that
which
you
is low temperature freezing and storage of a human corpse or a severed head with the speculative hope that with a resurrection could happen in the future.
Right.
And there is a company in Arizona that does this. It is called Alcor. So if
this
you
is
really
very vanilla
want,
sky.
Like if you're just really thinking that, well, I mean, just on the off chance. This has become a thing. Mm-hmm. You can pretty much, it's like donating your body to science.
Yeah. Right.
Essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. You can donate your body to be cryogenically frozen, which mm-hmm. is a thing that you can do. It's just we have no proof that anything will happen in the future.
Right. You can't do it in the
body.
Hope that you'll be resurrected. You do it just to say, well, you can study.
You can also cryogenically freeze your pet.
Oh. That's just. Mm-hmm. That's so sad.
Yeah.
Like, I
that
get
just,
it.
I
but
know.
That's so sad.
That just.
I
melts me.
Can you imagine, though? Yeah. Okay, imagine you die mm-hmm. and you feel awesome. It is the best you've ever felt.
Sure.
Peace, love. You're just full of love. You get to see all your past
like,
loved ones. You're floating around. You're one with the
you're
universe.
You're like catching up with your great grandma.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're
living
one with the
dream.
Universe. You know everything. Everything is great. And you're living your truth. And all of a sudden, you get sucked back.
Someone brings
to
you
Earth.
Back.
And it's just one of those things that, like, what is your consciousness going to be once you come back?
Yeah.
And there's a whole thing of when you look up YouTube videos of people that actually do this, and they walk you through the steps of what they do in preserving your brain when it's frozen. Of just, like, I mean, what are you going to come back like? If they can't put your head on, like, a machine or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Oof.
Count me out.
Yeah,
when
I don't,
die,
I don't
let
out.
Me die.
Just I mean, let me be free.
It's also like the least eco-friendly death product. Yeah. That like, I'm sure that you're just like wasting all of these natural resources just to keep your body frozen.
You're ruining
precious, useless fucking sack of bones.
And we also, don't need you.
This shit ain't cheap. So it's $200,000 or more for a whole body cryopreservation. $80,000 for the head only option.
Ew.
It's a head-only option.
Don't worry, it's just $80,000 for the head.
Now I see what you're saying. When you're like, what happens when you come back? You were talking about if you come back as a head.
Mm-hmm. Who wants that?
What happens then?
You're
now
just
you're just a
head.
A head.
Mm-hmm.
It's
going to
be like
squiggle
a Mars
around?
Attack situation where they sew you on the body of a chihuahua.
Right?
And that's how you have to live
like,
your life.
Like, why?
Sarah Jessica Parker style.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anyways, all right.
But yeah, well, I mean, you can do Google searches of this company in Arizona, Alcor. And I mean, the part about it that I kind of love is that all of these guys are so sincere talking about it.
Of course they
that
are.
This is something they that they truly believe in. Of that they don't use it. They pretty much don't say, like, if we can make this happen.
They're like, when it's possible. Yep.
It's possible.
Like, get ready.
So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of – there's not a lot to
not a
the
lot
cryogenically
to
frozen
head.
Head of Walt Disney, but okay, I love fair. It as an urban legend.
I was going to say, it's just – as we always say, it's fun to believe.
And guess what? It's going to live on. And I am not letting this one go.
It's so prominent. The family had to comment on it in the 70s of that, like, my father,
so many
I don't think
talking.
Had ever heard of this, and he is definitely not frozen.
Guys, please,
please
stop,
stop looking for his body.
Mm-hmm. No, but I'm with Ashley. Every time I ride Pirates of the Caribbean, I'm still going to imagine that his head is underneath it because it's just it brings me joy.
Cool,
you know,
from the water.
And Pirates opened like months after Walt passed too.
Yeah,
so, funny.
There you go.
Yeah,
funny,
coincidence,
isn't it?
Put his body down there and just like
put a ride on top of it.
He's like, I'm about to die. I know you guys are creating this awesome ride. Put me in there so I can feel a part
there.
Of it. Oh, yep, I believe it.
So my next topic is. It has to do with kind of Disney ripoffs or Disney artists lifting a story and art from other properties.
I don't know anything
and this is
about
something
this.
That you see a lot just in entertainment in general. I mean, there's only so many ideas sometimes, and sometimes you have to lift something from somebody else.
Yeah.
It happens a lot. Pixar's Cars, that plot is pretty much reworked from a Michael J. Fox movie called Doc Holliday.
Really?
It's all of the same exact beats of Cars. Watch Doc Holliday.
What?
The Lion King, its story resembles an anime called Kimba and the White Lion.
And it's Kimba and Simba.
And it sort of hits all of these similar beats of The Lion King. And one of the directors was living in Japan at the time.
Kimba probably would have
been on. So, You
well,
connect
was
the
it,
dots.
Was the Lion King is known as Disney's first original story. Which is funny.
Everything was based off like fairy tales,
and
kind
fairy
of.
Fairy tales, or,
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or, well, that's the thing, and is that it's like, the, but it's Hamlet.
The directors have even said, like, Hamlet and William Shakespeare was a major inspiration.
Yeah,
no,
yes.
Like, they usually admit for those older movies, hey, here was our inspo, we're front and center about that. But you're right. Lion King was very
was
like, this
first,
is our
like,
story.
This is one that we wrote. It's not based off of, even Song of the South was Uncle Remus stories.
Right.
Which were, you know, written by a white man, but they were
great, but
told. To him by a man named Uncle Remus, who is
story.
A or former slave.
Usually children's books.
Yep.
Like or children's books, yeah.
The Rescuers, The Fox and the Hound, The Black Cauldron.
The Aristocats.
The Aristocats,
Everybody
Dalmatians.
Wants to be
But Love one it. Of the ones that I find the most interesting, have either of you heard of The Thief and the Cobbler?
No.
Mm-mm.
So The Thief and the Cobbler is from the Canadian animator Richard Williams, who spent decades making this Arabian Nights-style movie that was insanely ambitious for the time, and it holds the record for the longest production schedule for a completed feature movie of 28 years.
And this is animation.
Animation.
Animation, okay.
And at one point in the 70s, a Saudi prince agreed to be the financial backer. And Richard Williams at the time was just a total character and would just work day and night on The Thief and the Cobbler. And it was just insanely ambitious that the type of animation that he was making, not even Walt and his animators would even bother with this. It was that much work.
Wow.
It was that many frames. And it just sort of became his reason for living, working day and night on it. And these images are just super crisp and lifelike. And the animation was just painstaking and nothing like it had ever been done. Everything is vibrant and busy. And there's just something going on in every single shot of the movie. And due to independent funding and complex animation, The Thief and the Cobbler was in and out of production for over two decades until Williams was pretty much scooped up by Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis. And do you know what he went to go work on?
Was it Indiana Jones?
No.
Damn.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Oh my gosh!
So he's sort of the pioneering animator that would drop in Roger Rabbit with people.
Yeah.
Like and like when you revisit Roger Rabbit, Pete and I were watching a little bit of it last night. Those scenes are fucking amazing.
They're amazing.
Yeah, they look incredible.
Like when it's just how seamless those characters act with people.
Yes. Right.
That
they cast shadows, which
like,
is
everything doesn't look jerky, and it's just I think it's just because of the high frame rate, that everything just looks so crisp and beautiful.
Yeah.
It really flows together. Because even Disney the first one to do that? Because I know they did it with Song of the South. They did it with Three Cabreros. But like...
I mean, the big thing is also Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins.
That they were the most dynamic with Dick Van Dyke dancing with the penguins.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, even though it's humans and... animation in Song of the South, but I don't think it looks as cool as Mary Poppins.
It certainly does not.
So we saw how Roger Rabbit turned out. It was a gigantic hit in 1988 when it came out.
Richard Williams ended up winning
multiple Oscars in animation and his effect work for Roger Rabbit. Because of the success of that movie, Warner Brothers was like, sure, we'll fund your movie. And from 1989 to 1992, he went to go work on it again for Warner, and then Warner ended up dropping its funding, which pretty much left the movie in pieces. And guess what other movie came out in 1992?
Aladdin.
Aladdin came out, beating kind of the thief and the cobbler to the punch and taking a lot of the visuals from that movie. And okay, let's think about it. I'm sure that animators that worked on Aladdin probably knew of this movie. They've probably
It
was probably a major inspiration when they were doing concept art. And much of The Thief and the Cobbler's fingerprints are everywhere in that movie. Mm. Everything has a striking resemblance. The style and characters of The Thief and the Cobbler, for example, the character of Zigzag from Thief shares many physical characteristics with both Aladdin's villain Jafar and its genie, because I think that they're both blue. They kind of have that blue character.
Oh, okay.
They kind of have that blue character design. Okay. And just the animators would have used that as a visual reference. And there's been no official statements from Disney about them pretty much lifting all of Richard Williams'
concept. They just say it's their original.
Yeah.
Their original idea. Mm.
And then the film went on to Fred Calvert, Fred at Creative Caspers Entertainment. Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know how you said Calvert, it once.
So pretty much like another studio just ended up taking the movie from him.
Okay.
We're going to finish it. And it took them 18 months to finish the film, and it was turned into a Disney-type production, probably just because this production house just wanted to capitalize off of the wild success of something like Aladdin. But it's just like... this animation was so wildly complex that they sort of had to kind of do stuff to match it. And I don't think that they ever really did it. And Miramax ended up getting the footage in the mid-90s, cutting it into a feature, and filled in the spaces where the movie was finished. And the irony behind that is, who owns Miramax?
Disney.
So it was just sort of Disney, like, oh, well, like, we'll capitalize off of this movie that we already ripped off.
Yep.
And it's one of those things, too, that Pete and I have tried to sit through The Thief and the Cobbler, and it's a beautiful movie, but it's just a mess.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that's not really his movie.
Yeah.
It's just, like, he's not really signing off on any of this.
Right.
Like, it's worth the... track down if you're just interested in it, just to see where the Aladdin influences are.
But also, if you fucking look at it, how are these not Aladdin characters?
Yeah. Like,
look at
Aladdin.
This. One thing, I have a funny... right?
Okay.
Okay.
This is
how
absurd.
How is that not Aladdin?
It's literally Aladdin. Oh, like, every character. I can see everyone here.
Yeah.
Even, like, when Jafar looks like an old gremlin in the cave.
And do you know who the voice of Zigzag is?
Who?
It's Vincent Price. Vincent Price died during the making of it.
Stop.
So they just had to use whatever dialogue
bites that
they
had
with
him. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Jennifer Beals, I believe, is their Princess Jasmine character.
Okay.
And Matthew Broderick is sort of their crazy Aladdin character. You should look up
the
main protagonist, because just it has this crazy look to it.
Okay. Yeah, it's this guy with like needles in his mouth.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Okay, cool.
All right. Well, I'm into it.
The Aladdin thing that I wanted to bring up that I found when I was researching this episode is that, do you know how they got Robin Williams to play the genie?
Mm-mm.
So the animators that were making the film, that were working for Disney at the time, took like 20 minutes of Robin Williams' stand-up And they animated it with the genie. So like there was one moment in his stand-up where he's like talking to himself as another person. So they made the genie grow two heads and talk to himself.
So cool.
And Robin Williams was like, this is brilliant. I
said it was the funniest thing ever.
Yeah, he was like, unlimited potential, I'm in.
What a great way to sell it to him. Seriously. That is so smart. And his whole thing is a stand-up bit.
And also with Robin Williams, we don't have to go too into it, but Robin Williams naively signing on to that movie of like, I'm not doing this to sell anything.
Yeah.
Like, that's not my gig, but I mean, it's Disney.
It's Disney. Yeah.
So it was kind of a struggle that he always had with those movies of that, I'm going to voice the genie. Like, I'm not going to just sell crap for you.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really work with a company like that.
Right.
No. Mm-hmm. No, you should know when you're working for, if you're doing a Disney or now these days a Marvel movie, yes, you are a brand. You are not an actor.
You have become part of the brand. Become you Tony are not Stark. An individual.
Congratulations. Yep. Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. Who?
Irish animators Tom Moore, who did The Secret of the Kells, Song of the Sea, and The Wolf Talkers, have also cited Williams' Thief and the Cobbler as being a major influence on their animation. If you've seen any of those movies, it definitely has that particular style to it. So I kind of like that.
Yeah.
That, like, his influence has
lived on.
Kind of lived on yeah. and inspired despite other being creatives. Stolen.
Right. Yeah.
That's so, good. Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of an interesting story. And sure. Williams ended up dying in 2019.
Damn, that was recent.
Yeah, he ended up doing one last short. I can't remember the name of it, but it was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, wow. What?
Okay.
So, yeah,
that's fine.
So he did create something right before he passed.
Right. God, he didn't like the thing when you were like, oh, Disney stole this story. I was just waiting for you to be like, and he died in a puddle of his own piss in the center. You know what I mean?
And
like,
nobody came and
no
looked
one knew
for
his
him.
Name. Yeah. Yeah. So the fact that he like kept going and was able to work his whole life is like
left a little legacy.
Has this huge following in the animation community of that you really changed.
He's
the game
recognized
with people something like Roger Rabbit. That that was incredible, and it still holds up. That it looks
100%.
Like
I will watch that movie right fucking
it's
now.
It's so good.
So kind of, I was trying to find other dark. Sad
Strange.
Tales of Disney's past. Mm-hmm. And are you familiar with the child actor Bobby Driscoll? Who is kind of a Disney actor. I don't think he was
Bobby
official.
Driscoll.
He was an official Mouseketeer, but he is also the voice of Peter Pan.
Okay.
He wasn't in... No, never
He was
mind.
In Song of the South.
Yes, okay. Yes. I was going to say, I recognize that name. He was. He was a little boy in Song of the South.
Okay, so he did a few Disney.
Wow. So he was a Disney contract child actor of film and TV performances from 1943 to 1960. He starred in some of the most known Disney films from the period, such as Song of the South, So Dear to My Heart, The Window, and Treasure Island. And he, most iconically, is the voice of Peter Pan in their animated movie in 1953, and he received the Junior Oscar for his performances in So Dear to My Heart and The Window, back when they used to give child
Oscars,
actors,
like specifically.
I think that like Haley Mills was the last one
we
to get one.
We should still do that. Why
I
don't
know.
We do that?
The BAFTA, well, I mean, the BAFTAs have the Rising Star.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
We need that equivalent.
We need a BAFTA.
Kinda,
why not?
I don't know why we're not. There's great. Job.
There's so many good performances.
So
yeah.
Kind of. Bobby Driscoll's story is kind of a tragic one. When he went through puberty, he was pretty much dropped from Disney. Of that, you're not really cute anymore. You kind of turned into a funny-looking
That's the problem
teenager.
With child actors. You don't know what they're going to, you know.
What's going to happen?
Are they going to end up being a Hayden Panettiere? Mm-hmm. Or are they going to end up being a Haley Joel Osment?
Or,
or
the kid from the Partridge Family.
Danny just a little funny
Danny
looking.
Bonaducci.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Danny
okay,
Bonaducci.
Of course.
Yeah.
Ooh, he ended up.
Not
I
only
like
is
now,
he funny looking, he's insane.
I was like, every interview or like video insane. I see of him, he looks like a crazy, and I just get creep vibes from him, to be honest.
He was in the Celebrity Real World. What was that show called?
The Surreal Life.
Surreal Life.
Oh my
the surreal
God.
Life so, got him off.
The surreal life from the really Brady Bunch. Yeah, what a fall from grace.
So after he went through puberty, he was pretty much dropped from Disney, and his parents withdrew him from the Hollywood Professional School, which served a lot of child actors at the time. When he left the school, his grades began to drop substantially, and he became a target of ridicule for his work with Disney. And surprise, surprise, he turned to drugs as an outlet.
Oh,
well.
Saying, the other kids didn't accept me. They treated me as one apart. I tried desperately to be one of the gang. When they rejected me, I fought back, became belligerent and cocky, and was afraid all the time. And Driscoll started to use marijuana and heroin.
Those are two different drugs.
Yeah. Very different drugs. Like, what was he looking for?
He still did a little bit of TV work. His last known appearance on TV were small roles in the series The Best of the Post, a syndicated anthology series adapted from the Saturday Evening Post stories, and The Brother.
Never heard of it.
And just kind of other small TV things.
Right. He didn't
at the time. Yeah. So he didn't really go on to do very much. Late 1961, he was sentenced as a drug addict and imprisoned.
Sentenced as a drug addict?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that he probably just got caught buying drugs.
Yeah, for sure.
And he was sent to Chino. At the California Institution for Men. So, like, pretty much like the prison in Chino.
Yeah.
And when Driscoll left Chino in 1962, he was unable to find any acting work. He later moved to New York City in 1965 after his parole and attempted to come back to acting, but it never really happened. He ended up falling in with the Warhol crowd at the factory in the mid-60s.
Well,
during his tenure at the factory, Driscoll gave his last known film performance in an experimental movie called Dirt. So he kind of rolled with the Warhol crew, which the Warhol crew
sounds fun.
Was a ragtag
group, but also like probably hit drugs really, really hard.
I was going to say,
stuff
like
heroin.
The drug life. Yeah.
And on March 30th, 1968, two boys playing in an abandoned warehouse in the East Village found his body lying on a cot next to two empty beer bottles and religious pamphlets on the ground.
Was it an overdose?
It was an overdose. Yeah. It was a heart failure. And they couldn't find any identification on
Peter
the body.
Pan.
And they pretty much just thought that he was just like a homeless person. And they put his body in an unmarked pauper's grave in New York City's Heart Island.
Oh,
what?
So, yeah.
Is it marked now?
In the late 60s, Driscoll's mother, with the help of officials at Disney Studios, tried to find him. And they ended up getting a fingerprint match with the New York City Police Department.
God.
And they traced his burial to Heart Island. And they found him. So they brought his remains back to Oceanside, California, still there.
Wow.
So yeah, so this very, like, kind of the saddest child actor story in history.
Very sad. And it's got competition.
I was going to say,
it's got a lot of competition.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Especially that originally, it's like, here you go, homeless man in your unmarked grave. Mm-hmm. Like,
guess boys
down.
Do
yeah,
grow up.
I hate to bring down the party, but just kind of a sad story.
Seriously.
But it's one of those things that I think it was something that I would have had to been watching Peter Pan and just like found this on IMDb and just went
just
on like a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Of just like, oh my God, this sad story about the actor from Peter Pan.
Very sad.
The things that you find when you're on your IMDb rabbit holes, too.
You can go down.
So many. I'm not going to cover my stuff today. If you guys would like to know a little bit about Disney's history in films such as Song of the South and Pocahontas, I think you can see where I'm going with this. It's going to be a part of our bonus episode. We're going to be covering more Disney stuff on that. So if you'd like to check that out, it's going to be in our Patreon at www.patreon.com/keepitweirdpodcast. The one thing I did just like quickly want to go over is my original idea for this episode, which didn't quite pan out, was that I wanted to do Disney conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But there really wasn't anything more than what everyone knows.
Sure.
Everyone goes over these
the
all the time.
Yeah.
And I can debunk most of them. So
let's
here
go.
We
yeah.
go.
Let's hear it.
There's a penis on the cover of Little Mermaid. Yes and no.
There was.
There is a penis on the cover of Little Mermaid.
But they changed it. They changed the cover so you can't find it now. But the original cover, my VHS that was half chewed on by my dog.
There's a dick on it.
Straight up
dick. The only thing is, the animator was like, I swear to God,
that
was drawing a castle.
The intention. But man,
I did not mean to make that tower phallic.
But it is
a it's not even that it's just phallic. It looks like it has veins on it.
Looks like it has veins. It's got a tip. Yeah.
So I remember my sisters giggling at that.
Yeah.
When I was young.
Always.
And just
you had older sisters,
box.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just being like, what are you looking at?
What are you looking at? Like, this beautiful castle?
Yeah. And I think that I had to get on the internet at the age of like 11 to figure it out.
Yeah. To be like, why are my sisters
like,
laughing
why are my
at
sisters
the cover
losing
of
their
the
damn
Little
minds
Mermaid.
At the cover of the box of The Little Mermaid?
I giggled at it all the time. So funny.
So it's not, you know, Not supposed to be. Also, the priest during Ariel's wedding supposedly has a boner. The animator says it was supposed to be his knee. So that was also an accident.
Yeah.
But it does look like a boner.
It's just a weird
unfortunately,
angle.
Unfortunately,
it's a fun one.
Look a little bit like a boner. The scene in The Lion King where Simba collapses in the grass and a bunch of like pollen or flowers or whatever blows up and spells the word sex. It actually spelled SFX. It was supposed to be a subtle nod to the animators, but oops, kind of looked like sex. And now everyone thinks it's sex.
Yeah, which like an F and an E, we get it.
Listen, you look at it and it's fun. Like, that looks like sex, it but sure also does. It could be SFX. It was just a nice just little nod to the animators.
Still giggle.
Aladdin did not say all good teenagers take off their clothes. He said, down, kitty, take off and go. This is definitely a Yanny and Laurel situation.
It is. Sure.
Because you can hear whichever one you want.
If you're thinking about it,
it will sound like whichever one you like. It's a Yanny and Laurel situation, not a giant pedophile mastermind trying to subliminally suggest things.
Take the clothes. That's what it sounds
daughters.
Like in your brain.
It does.
Teenagers, take off the clothes.
But it wasn't. So, yeah, like I said, I'm going to be covering on the bonus episode this month, I'm going to be covering basically what went down with Song of the South.
Oof.
And how it's not a new problem. I think a lot of people assume that someone saw it today and went, that's super racist.
Oh.
But really,
yeah, I mean, it was controversial at the time.
People told him not to make that film.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, that's the one time you can't look at Walt and say, man of his time. No. You were advised not to make that
movie. He met with civil rights groups to hear them out. And I think that the groups kind of walked away from the meeting thinking like, okay, like,
we got to him.
I think we got to him. And then they went to the movie.
Well, and unfortunately, the problem is that after that, Disney, as we know, did not learn their lesson.
No.
There's a lot of... Which episode did you talk about queer coding? Because I want to direct people to
it. We talked about queer coding on our episode on Robin Hood that just came out.
Was it on Robin Hood?
It was on Robin Hood.
That's why I haven't heard it yet. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
that makes sense.
On Movies That Made Us Gay, they just talked about a Disney movie. They just talked about Robin Hood, which is actually one of my favorites. I love Robin Hood.
And you know, Robin Hood was supposed to be set in the South.
Well,
was it really? I'm glad it wasn't.
That's why the movie sort of does. There are certain character and voice performances that you could see. Okay. Like, I can see what probably the idea of this movie was, and then they sort of decided to pull back from it.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know what? For good reason. They probably shouldn't do that. Anyways, yes.
Queer coding is fascinating. You need to learn about it.
Yeah. A lot of Disney movies have done it. And also, when they did Pocahontas, they also sort of met with Native American tribes. Yeah. They met with Native American historians and basically ignored everything they said.
Right.
So it's like, so nice of you to do this, but was it just for publicity? Why did you not take any notes from these fucking people?
Right. I remember I was taking in college Native American history classes, and our main film instructor that teaches the American Western film, Native Americans in cinema, she always would just roll her eyes at it. Like, this is a movie about Native Americans, and it's just made by a bunch of white people.
Yes.
It's told completely
wrong. Its ideas are, like, there. The intentions
are there, but it just sort of
doesn't work.
It didn't quite make it there. And that has an example of queer coding in it, too, with the main villain being a little more feminine. And I was reading an article about it where it's like John Smith was made out to look like the nice colonizer because he was masculine and he understood Pocahontas. But the more feminine man who cared about his fashion choices and had his little pug was looked at as evil.
Which, listen to the bonus episode this month if you want to hear what really happened to that man, because it fucking rocks.
I'm very excited.
But that is all the time we have this week for Keep It Weird. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thank you so much, Scott, for coming on the show again.
We love you, Scott.
It was good to see you, gals. Nice to see you.
Face to face.
I know.
We're about to go play a round or two of Disney trivia, and I'm going to lose really hard. Do you have anything to plug aside from Movies That Made Us Gay, which we've already plugged several times, and you guys should go listen to it? What's the Instagram? It's just at Movies That Made Us Gay, right?
MTMUGpod on Twitter. Follow me on Letterboxd at Scott Youngbauer, Oscar Scott on Twitter, and Scott Youngbauer on Instagram.
Yes.
I was just on the Sewers of Paris podcast with our guest Matt Baum that was on our Robin Hood episode. I talked about the 20-year anniversary of Six Feet Under.
Love
and
it.
Just how, oh, gosh, what a huge that influence that show was for me as a young gay person. I talk a little bit about that. So, yeah.
I love it.
I mean, that we have an episode perfect a week.
Yep. And crazy, they're all fantastic. Yep. And Lauren and I are on several of them.
You are,
so
yeah,
if you like us, you can start out with those.
We got you twice during the pandemic. One for Encino yeah Man, and oh, Joe yeah came on for that one. And the other one was The Cell.
Yeah.
And oh, yeah, The Cell.
We love that crazy
movie. Oh, my gosh. I came on for What Lies Beneath. Yeah. And like, pre-pandemic, I came on for, what was it?
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Oh, of course, like one how of my all-time you favorites. I know. Ashley absolutely
and then
could
the
have done
two
that
of us were on an episode together. We did The Witches.
Which, of course.
And then I also came on for Death Becomes Her. Yeah. Guys, there's so many good movies.
Gotta go yeah check it.
That you don't hear other podcasts talk about. So I think you should check it out. Make sure that you're following us on social media as well at Keep It Weird Cast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I guess if you're on there, we're not really on there. But so you can keep up with everything we are doing. Make sure that you join us next week because we are going to continue our Disney series. We're going to dive into Disney parks.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
And we're going to be discussing some of the really cool history involving Disney World, Disneyland, and probably some other locations as well. And our guest is going to be
Alex Ogle, my husband, finally
here
after
to defend
five
his
freaking
king
years.
If you want to help us produce our show, check out our Patreon at www.patreon.com/keepitweirdpodcast. You can donate $1, $5, or $10 to our show once, or you can set it up to donate monthly, and you'll get bonus episodes, a newsletter, discounts on merch, and shout-outs on our show in return for helping us make this possible. You can also head over to our Etsy store at etsy.com/shop/keepitweirdpodcast and get one of our new shirts.
They are the cutest.
Or one of our old shirts. Whatever you want to buy, they're all on sale.
Tote bag.
Shirts, tank tops, hoodies, sweatpants, even blankets. You can get them all in our Etsy store. Guys, what is our sign-off today? What's a real Disney sign-off?
TTFN, ta-ta for now.
That was a bad ticker.
How would Disney sign off?
Bippity boppity boo.
That's a good question.
Keep it magic.
It was basically our sign off, but keep it magic.
Keep it magic.
Keep it magic and weird.
Bye.
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 And I'll cut all this dead fucking air.
Sure.
I think we're making magic right now.
Oh, just kidding. This is all staying in.